Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Roger Biles about his book about the life and political career of Chicago Mayor Harold Washington, entitled Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yes, I'm an emeritus professor of history at Illinois State University. I retired about 2 years ago. And although I'm not teaching anymore, I'm still active as a scholar, and I'm researching and writing, and probably will continue to do that for a little while.
You have a very extensive body of works, including biographies of other Chicago mayors, such as Richard J. Daley and Edward Kelly. What was it that led you to decide to write a biography of Harold Washington?
Well, I sort of came to it in a roundabout way. I was at the Harold Washington Library in Chicago doing research in the special collections area, doing research on another project, actually. And I was talking with the archivists there, and one of them mentioned the fact that not many folks had gotten into the Harold Washington papers. Which the archivist said was surprising to the people who worked there, because it's a very large and rich manuscript collection. And so I started poking around in there and found it to be fascinating. And so that's what led me to the project.
Harold Washington did lead this very interesting life, and you describe how it began with his parents, and this how they were part of this great migration up to the north in the early 20th century. Was Harold Washington, could you explain a bit about his childhood and that influence that it had on his life?
Right. Well, his parents were part of what historians refer to as the Great Migration. That was the great migration of African Americans from the South to northern and western cities around the time of the First World War. And Harold Washington was born in Chicago, born in Cook County Hospital, after his parents had relocated there. And he grew up and effectively spent his whole life in Chicago, went to the public schools there, eventually was educated at Roosevelt University, which is located in Chicago, and then Northwestern University Law School, which is in greater Chicago. So he spent most of his life in the city.
He also struck me as having a very solitary life. You describe how he had this his large family. His mother had six children, and yet he there's this reference you make when he's mayor about how he just sort of dismisses his family as they're kind of irrelevant. He was married briefly early as a young man, but he really did seem to have a career that was very much focused on his life was very much focused on politics.
Well, that's true. He was a pretty solitary character. He was, as you said, married early before his time in the Army, and then the Second World War, and then came back and was divorced and never got remarried. And so he was pretty much of a loner in many respects. And a lot of people commented about that aspect of his personality. He was a politician, and he was very good at the kinds of things that politicians have to do, the kind of interactions and so forth. But in his personal life, he was very careful to put a wall around himself, and not many people felt that they knew him terribly well.
How did he get started in politics? What was it that drew him to it, and how did he begin his ascent?
Well, he got involved in politics early on because of his father, basically. His father was involved in politics on Chicago's South Side. His father was a very well-known and influential precinct captain in the Democratic Party. And really, from his earliest days, Harold Washington tagged along behind his father and handed out leaflets and canvassed and these sorts of things. And he just grew up with politics as an important part of his household.
How did he start out basically as part of an organization? Did he start out, you know, as an independent? And how did he that ultimately translate into public office?
Well, he grew up as a member of the Democratic Party in Chicago, which, of course, his father was an important member of. And at that time, as many, I think, people will recall, the Democratic Party was a power in Chicago. There has not been, if I'm correct about this, there's not been a Republican mayor in Chicago since the early 1930s. Chicago has been a Democratic bastion for a long time. So Washington grew up as a loyal Democratic Party member and was elected to his first offices in the Illinois State Legislature as a loyal Democrat, and later on developed a sort of independence. But in the beginning, he was very much a party man.
That's interesting because you set that in the context of the time, which was a time when, as you described, when his father was starting out, African Americans tended to be more Republican than Democrat. And you describe people like Oscar DePriest, who is, you know, this famous congressman from Chicago, African American and a Republican. And I thought it was very interesting about how, in terms of his father, how that fit. And it was very fortuitous in the sense that he became part of this operation that was so important to Chicago politics.
Right. I think probably a lot of listeners will know that African American voters were very loyal generally to the Republican Party in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The Republican Party, of course, was the party of Lincoln and the party of emancipation. And so the big switch from the Republican to the Democratic Party for most African Americans didn't begin until the 1930s, 1940s, and so forth. Harold Washington's father was part of that movement of Chicago blacks from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, and so Harold Washington simply grew up in that environment.
I think that's one of the points we should probably address before we move into Harold Washington's time in the state legislature, and that is his role in the machine. This is the time when the mayor of Chicago is Richard J. Daley. He serves as mayor for over two decades, and he has this very famous electoral machine. And it's one that's, has received a lot of study, and including, you know, by yourself. And yet I think this needs a bit of explanation, because how exactly did this machine function? And how did African-Americans such as Harold Washington play a role in that machine? Because I think that's important in terms of understanding what happens a little bit later on in his career.
Right. Well, by the time that Harold Washington was growing up, the Democratic machine in Chicago, which is, you know, usually referred to as the last of the great urban political machines, really had strong control of the city. And African Americans in Chicago were, by the 1950s and 1960s, very loyal supporters of the Democratic Party. And so Washington grew up in a situation in which blacks on the South Side of Chicago, which is where he grew up, inevitably, it seemed, voted for the Democrats, voted for Richard J. Daley. That began to change later on, by the way. But when Washington was coming of age politically, there really seemed to be just one alternative for African-American voters, and that was to vote for Richard J. Daley, and for the Democrats. And so when, excuse me, when Washington became involved in politics initially, he was what was known as an organization Democrat. He was loyal to Daley and loyal to the organization. And that's literally how he got started in politics. He ran for the state legislature and was elected as a machine Democrat.
You describe his career in the state legislature, and you point out that he, you know, generally was a loyal member of the Democratic caucus and the Daley organization. But you also explained that he had these periods of independence. What you describe is it sounds like he was walking this tightrope between the survival of his career on the one side and the demands of his conscience on the other.
Yes, and I think that represented a kind of evolution for him. I believe that when he first went down to Springfield, went to the state legislature, which was in the mid-1960s, I think he was a loyal Democrat and somebody who pretty much followed the dictates of the machine. They used to tell the story about how the representatives from Chicago would go to the General Assembly every morning, and they would be given what were called their idiot sheets. And these were simply pieces of paper that listed the legislation that would be coming up for a vote that day, and the legislators were told how to vote. As a member of the Chicago machine, this is what you're expected to do. There was no explanation. There was no discussion. This is the way you vote. And I think Washington did that for a while, but I think it bothered him, and he had some questions. And at that time, as a Chicago Democrat who was representing the city in the state legislature, you didn't ask questions. You simply accepted your marching orders and you did what you were told to do. And over time, he began to exhibit a little bit more independence. He began to ask questions. And occasionally, when he was bothered enough, he began to vote the other way. And that caused a certain amount of friction with Mayor Daley back in Chicago. And over time, Washington developed a reputation of an independent, somebody who often voted his own conscience. And of course, that was something that was not really valued very highly back in City Hall in Chicago.
How is it then that he was able to survive? Well, why didn't the Daley machine try to turn him out in favor of someone who was more, able to toe the line?
Right. Well, I think there are a couple of explanations to that. Part of the answer to your question is simply that they did try on a couple of occasions and selected somebody to run against him. But he was, in fact, a very good first of all, a representative, and then second of all, a state senator. And his constituents really liked him. They thought that he did a very good job of representing them. He worked very hard. And so he was simply able to withstand a lot of that pressure. Now, I certainly don't want to overstate this. I don't want to create the impression that Washington did whatever he wanted to do all the time, because he didn't. I think he picked his spots. I think when an issue came along that was of particular importance to him, then he would go his own way and ignore his marching orders. And as I said, he did it often enough that he started to get a reputation in Chicago. But I also think that he was, as you said, sort of walking a tightrope. He had his own ideas. He was something of an independent person himself. But at the same time, he recognized that politically it was important for him to remain in the good graces of the political machine. So I think for a number of years, it was a delicate balancing act for him.
Was that independence a factor in 1977 when he was first being discussed as a mayoral candidate?
Yes, I think one of the points I make in the book is that by the 1970s and 1980s, a number of cities in the country, a number of big cities in the U.S., had elected black mayors. But that had not happened in Chicago. Chicago, of course, was, well, at first the second largest city in the country and then surpassed by Los Angeles, but one of the largest cities in the country and one of the few that had not elected a black mayor. And there were a number of African Americans in Chicago by that time, by the 1970s, who were very unhappy, and they felt that they'd been loyal supporters of the political machine for literally decades, but they weren't getting enough in return, and they began to question Mayor Daley. They began to register their displeasure with some of the decisions coming out of City Hall. And so there were rumblings of independence and suggestions that blacks should run one of their own for mayor. They attempted it in 1975, but that really didn't go anywhere. Another African American ran and didn't do terribly well. But then in 1977, the opportunity came around again after Mayor Daley had died. And the Chicago black community chose Washington to run for mayor. And by that time, the feeling was that he was probably the most successful, the best known African American politician in the city. He'd had a very distinguished career in the state legislature, and people thought he would be the best candidate. And by 1977, I think Washington had pretty much decided that the connection with the political machine had been severed, and he was ready to make that run.
So he makes so he does this, and how well does it turn out for him?
Well, not very well. There had been a lot of disgruntlement. African Americans were very unhappy. The African American population in Chicago had increased tremendously, but the problem was, even though the African American population was quite significant by that time, the number of registered voters were not. And so when Washington ran in 77, he didn't do terribly well. And he, of course, he wasn't very happy about that, and simply said to other leaders in the African American community, "Well, this just isn't going to happen. Don't come back and ask me again until certain conditions are met." And the first condition, of course, is the mass registration of African American voters.
So what you're describing basically is sort of this sleeping giant of a populace, and there's another factor that you mentioned in your book as well a little bit later on, which is how this is happening at a time when you're seeing with the civil rights movement, African Americans are beginning to become more organized for their own needs. They're beginning to mobilize more, and it seems like that hasn't happened quite yet in Chicago, and that's sort of the condition that distinguishes 1977 from 1983. Am I reading that correctly?
I think so. I've talked a little bit about the numbers problem. That is, the fact that there just weren't the number of wasn't the number of registered black voters to make a difference. The other problem too was a kind of factionalization in the black community. There were lots of different groups, civil rights groups, black, what were then called black power groups, and so on and so forth. And one of the conditions that had to be met was that all of these different groups had to coalesce and back a single candidate and work in unison. And that was another problem too. It just wasn't happening in Chicago as quickly as it had happened in some other communities. So that that kind of unity wasn't there in 1977, but it was by 1983.
So what does Harold Washington do in the interim? Does he stay in the state legislature or does he look for a different office?
Well, he's, as I said, he served several terms in the Illinois House and then moved up to the Illinois Senate, serving two terms there. And then in 1980, decided to run for the U.S. House of Representatives. The person who had represented Chicago from the first congressional district was no longer in the picture. And by all accounts, Washington was the best known and the most capable African-American candidate. So he ran for the U.S. House and was elected overwhelmingly in 1980 and then was reelected again in 1982. So he went off to Washington.
One of the points you make in the that section is how quickly he engaged with the conservative revolution that was taking place in Washington, D.C. And I like the fact that you make it of a piece with his later work, his later issues as a mayor, because it was, in a sense, this entire period of his career from when he goes to Congress until his death is bracketed by the Reagan presidency and how he is engaging with it first as a congressman and then as a mayor. How does he respond to it, and what does that do for his profile?
That's exactly right. Harold Washington got elected and went off to serve in the U.S. Congress at the same moment that Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president. And during the rest of his life, during the rest of Harold Washington's life, Ronald Reagan was in the White House. Well, when Washington went off to Washington, he did so with the reputation in Illinois and the state legislature of being a real progressive. And somebody who was opposed, really, to just about everything that Ronald Reagan stood for. And one of the things that's interesting about Washington when he got to Congress is that, unlike a lot of other freshman congressmen, he didn't really wait, sit on the back bench and observe and wait his time. He became very active and very outspoken from the very beginning. And outspoken in a way that was consistently critical of Ronald Reagan, critical of Reagan in terms of foreign policy, in terms of domestic policy. He was really rough on the new president and quickly earned a reputation of being one of Reagan's most vocal critics on Capitol Hill.
You mentioned that this didn't exactly hurt his standing in the Democratic caucus and that he was seen by a lot of people as a rising star. And which is why I find his decision to run 1983 so interesting, because it seemed like at this point he had these career options open to him. Mm-hmm. What made him decide to make another run for being mayor?
Well, that's a good question. When he was in Washington, D.C., and the speculation continued about him returning and running for mayor in Chicago, he told lots of people, including some newspaper reporters, that he loved being a U.S. congressman. It was a great life. He felt that he could make a real difference there. He enjoyed the work, and so on and so forth. And at the same time, as we've mentioned, he had sort of a rough experience a few years earlier when he ran for mayor and really just didn't get anywhere. He was, I think, very cautious and very wary about that. But ultimately, I suspect the thing that persuaded him to go back and run for mayor is that it's something that he'd wanted to do for a long time. As I mentioned before, he'd spent his whole life, virtually his whole life, in Chicago. He saw himself as being a Chicagoan, and he saw himself as somebody who could make a real difference in the city, particularly for his constituents. And because of events back in Chicago, I think he felt that the political situation in 1983 looked a lot better than it had in 1977. I think he thought it was possible to win. And he wasn't just tilting at windmills anymore. This was a different situation, and I think that played in his decision too.
So what was the conditions of the 1983 mayoral race? Whom was he running against, and what were the issues that were defining the race?
Well, in 1983, the race for mayor ended up being essentially a three-sided race within the Democratic Party. Now, at that time, that meant it was essentially a three-sided race, period, because, as we know, the Democrats won the mayoralty time and time again. That's just the way it was. And so whoever got the Democratic nomination for mayor was expected to be elected. And so it boiled down to three candidates. Richard M. Daley, the son of the former mayor, Richard J. Daley, and Jane Byrne, who was the incumbent, and Harold Washington, who was the black candidate. And at least for most of the beginning of the Democratic primary campaign, most people in Chicago, and this was a thought that was heavily supported by the press, most people thought that the race boiled down to Byrne versus Daley, and that Washington was something of an afterthought. His candidacy really wasn't taken terribly seriously for a long time.
You describe how the conditions that he had set in after 1977 were in fact met. He insisted that there be, I think it was 50,000 registered voters, and that so much
right.
money be raised, and how that was done for him, which to me speaks to the sense that many people had, that they wanted him to run, that they wanted him to stand up in this race, and that he had a strength that people like Mayor Byrne and a lot of the prognosticators of Chicago politics really seemed to miss at that time.
Right. He had originally said to the black community, you've got to register 50,000 more voters and raise a lot of money, or I'm not going to go through this again. And so it turns out that a variety of organizations in the community ended up registering over 100,000 new voters. So more than doubled the number he'd thrown out there, and they raised a lot of money. And as you say, I think that was because people recognized that Harold Washington was their best candidate, and if they were going to have a chance, they would have to entice him to run again.
And I think it's a very important point too, in another respect, which is you describe how during his campaign, it's a very unusual campaign in the sense that it's not an establishment campaign. It's not an insurgent campaign. It's schizophrenic in that it's both. and you to talk about how you presented this, it was something that was essentially necessary for him to pull together
right.
the votes.
Right. There were different groups who supported him. And the one thing that united them was the fact that they wanted to elect a black mayor, and they were convinced that Harold Washington was their best chance. But many of those groups didn't really agree on much else. There were a series of sort of militant black power people in the community who approached the election in a certain way, and then there were other sort of more mainstream types who saw things differently. There were some white liberals who were ended up being important in the campaign, and they often disagreed about a lot of things. The one thing that kept them together was the notion that, you know, they needed to pull together to elect this guy, Harold Washington. And there was a lot of conflict. There was a lot of tension between and among those groups. And I think Washington realized that he needed that support. He needed to bring together a lot of different groups. And so, you know, he had to manage that tension, which he did.
He succeeds in winning the Democratic nomination. And as you said, you know, in most years, that would be the end of the story. He could start picking out the pattern of the drapes in the mayor's office. But in 1983, of course, it's very different. You actually have this dramatic shift that takes place, which really, I think, speaks to just how momentous Washington's election was.
Right. After winning, defeating his two Democratic candidates, Washington and his folks began looking ahead. They started to discuss who they would bring into their cabinet and began writing policy papers and playing with budget numbers and so on and so forth. Their assumption was that was the end of that. The Republicans were running a candidate by the name of Bernard Epton, who had served for a number of years in the Illinois state legislature. In fact, he and Harold Washington had gotten along pretty well in the House for many years. They'd co-authored bills. They were certainly on very good terms. Epton was considered a kind of a minor political figure. But then again, the Republicans didn't think there was much hope of winning, so they nominated him. Well, lo and behold, something shocking happened. It wasn't Daley and it wasn't Byrne. It was Harold Washington who got the Democratic nomination. And that was, as I said, a real shocker in Chicago in 1983 because of race. And folks just couldn't wrap their minds around the idea of having a black mayor in Chicago. It was just something that people were an awful lot of people were uncomfortable with. And so great numbers of Democrats deserted their party and announced their intention to vote for Epton. And all of a sudden, Epton's chances, which previously had seemed negligible, seemed very real, and it became a real election.
One of the issues that came out of the race is the question of just how much support he was getting from the Democratic organization, and this mm-hmm. is where you introduce the figure of Edward Verdoliak. And he plays this
right.
huge role in terms of Washington's mayoralty. I was wondering if you could perhaps introduce him a little bit and explain what his position was this time and how he comes to shape so much of the mayoralty that Washington enjoyed.
Yeah, Eddie Verdoliak was an alderman from the 10th Ward, and he had been elected many years before. He was known as one of the most powerful aldermen in the Chicago City Council. He was something of a he was a controversial figure. He was something of a rascal, I guess. He was flamboyant and as I say, controversial maybe says it best. And he was also by that time, he was the chairman of the Democratic Party in Cook County. So he was a very powerful figure, arguably the most powerful figure in the city council. And the white opposition to Harold Washington's election in 1983 galvanized around Eddie Verdoliak.
He's walking something of a tightrope of his own during this period, which is that he has to stay. He's representing the party. Washington's the official nominee. But as you describe as well, Verdoliak also has ambitions for the mayor's office himself.
Well, you know, that was something about Verdoliak that Chicagoans had believed for years that he had his sights set on the mayor's office going back into the back into the 60s and 70s. He was a very ambitious politician, he was walking a bit of a tightrope in the sense that, you know, you would normally expect that the chairman of the party would do everything he could do to mobilize the party members and the voters behind their candidate. And yet, here's Vrdoljak leading, in a sense, surreptitiously at times, not so surreptitiously at other times, the opposition. People are deserting the Democratic Party. They say they're going to vote for Bernard Epton. One would suppose that Vrdoljak would be doing everything he could do to stop that, but in fact, he wasn't.
So, and yet, in spite of all this, Washington wins the election and becomes the mayor of Chicago. What were his plans for Chicago at this point? What did he want to do for Chicago? And in what ways did it differ from what previous mayors, such as Byrne and the elder Daley, had done for Chicago?
Right. Well, this is one of the major points, if not the major point that I would like to make in the book, and that is that Washington wanted to reform the system. We hear a lot about that word, right? Reform. What is a reformer, after all? Well, Washington had to establish something of a reputation over the years as somebody who jousted with the Democratic machine, was very critical of it. And at least initially, there were a lot of folks who didn't really believe all of his rhetoric. They thought that was just, what he needed to say to get elected. But I take him very seriously. And I think if you go back and look at the kinds of things he was saying going back, let's say, into the 1970s and into the 1983 election, I think that he had some real designs on how to reform Chicago, beginning with a series of papers that he put out called what became known as the Washington Papers, and then a document, the title of Chicago Works Together. I think if you look at those two documents, it's a pretty straightforward blueprint for how Washington wanted to reform city government in Chicago. He talked about things, for example, like fairness and transparency and neighborhood empowerment, balanced economic growth. One of his strongest, I think, values was this notion of fairness. He argued that, you know, the political machine that had ruled in Chicago for so long was just inherently unfair. And he used to like to say, I just love this, he used to like to say, no one but no one in this city will be safe from my fairness. And he argued that more than anything else, that would be the organizing principle of his government. He was going to bring resources to people who'd been ignored for years. He was going to preside over fair distribution of resources in the city. He was going to make sure that not all of the city's resources went into downtown, but that the neighborhoods be given attention, really, in some cases, for the first time. And so those were the kinds of reforms, I think, that he was concerned with. And I think it explains to a great degree why the opposition to him was so virile, because he not just race, but he also threatened the status quo in a very real way.
You describe how in the previous administrations, the focus was very loop-centric. The idea is they developed the downtown business that Chicago as a whole will benefit indirectly, and how Washington saw it as needing to do more to ensure that the other neighborhoods benefited, and that it combined that with an effort that was much more bottom up rather than the top down approach that had become the norm in Chicago for so long.
Right. I think he went to great lengths to explain that he wasn't really talking about starving the downtown and ignoring it altogether. But basically, he was saying, look, for decades, all of the resources have gone into the downtown. And what I'm talking about is leveling things off here a bit, taking some of those resources and making sure that they get out to the neighborhoods, because let's face it, the trickle down just isn't trickling down as much as some people would like to have us believe. So we need to make sure that all of the people, regardless of race or ethnicity or gender or anything else, are sharing in whatever bounty there is in the city.
He's advocating this in the face of a number of headwinds, and the most prominent of them was the opposition within the city council. I was wondering if you could explain a bit the city council organization and how it was that they were able to frustrate so much of his agenda throughout most of his first term.
Right. This is what the local media referred to as the council wars. That lasted really for about the first 3/4 of Washington's first term. It's a 50-person city council in Chicago. And after the 1983 election, Washington's opponents numbered 29 and his supporters numbered 21. Now, because of that numerical difference, his opponents did not have enough votes to override a mayoral veto, but obviously Washington supporters didn't have enough votes to pass legislation. And so the situation in Chicago just degenerated into a kind of very bitter standoff. And I would emphasize bitter because aldermen in city council chambers frequently insulted each other, occasionally got into shoving matches and so on and so forth, and essentially not much got done. And so this was the situation that pervaded Chicago for several years. And as you can well imagine, many people became very frustrated. Chicagoans were very concerned about the inadequacy of municipal government. Some people blamed Washington for his failure to compromise and to work with his opponents. On the other hand, of course, his supporters said, well, the opposition is blunting him at every turn. They're just not cooperating with him. And for those folks who might be thinking about that, I would suggest perhaps one parallel is the difficulty that President Barack Obama had with the Republican Congress at one time. Not a perfect comparison, but useful, I think.
Yet, in spite of this, Washington did enjoy some successes. What accomplishments was he able to achieve? And how was he able to ultimately surmount this challenge that was being posed by the Verdoli Act 29?
Well, in many ways, it's very unfortunate that he ran into that kind of situation because, as his opponents liked to gloat, many of his appointments to various positions in city government and many of the bills that he hoped would pass didn't. And so there was a kind of logjam there, and that's, terribly frustrating for him. he did manage to get some things done. Of course, in some cases, he could issue executive orders. In some creative ways, he could try to bypass the city council. But there were other ways, of course, in which he couldn't. In my view, he did manage to do some really positive things. One of the things he did that I think had a real significance, and people saw it immediately, had to do with the city budget. Now, traditionally in Chicago, the way it worked is that the mayor's office would construct a budget, which had to be approved by the city council by the end of the calendar year. So the mayor's office would send it over around the 1st of December or so to the city council, and they would rubber stamp it, and because after all, it was controlled by the machine. And that would be the budget-making process. Well, what Washington began to do is that he and his members of his administration would go out around the city, and they would have open budget meetings in neighborhoods throughout the community, engaging with the people of Chicago about what the priorities should be in the budget. And then they would go back to City Hall and they would construct a first draft, in a sense, of the budget. Then they would go back out and hold public hearings to get feedback. And then finally, in November, they would send the budget to the city council. And in that way, they really involved the citizens directly in the budget making process, which I think was very important because it allowed people to register what their priorities were. What should the city be spending its money on? How much money? And so on and so forth. Well, of course, the city council, you know, fought him tooth and nail about that, and there had to be compromises made and so forth. But it's that kind of thing, I think, that showed Chicagoans that there was an alternative, that city government didn't have to be secretive, and that it was possible to have people participate in the government. Another thing that the Washington administration did that I think was useful is that it attempted to provide seed money out in the neighborhoods for local industries. Providing money for local neighborhood organizations to go out and recruit. Washington and his folks believed that as we moved from an industrial to a post-industrial age, and as a lot of businesses were closing in Chicago, a lot of industry was fleeing the city, that one effective response could be smaller industries and smaller businesses that would be located in the neighborhoods, that you didn't have to go out and recruit huge corporations, but that it would be possible to at least make up for part of the loss by setting your sights somewhat lower. And so there was a kind of decentralization economically as well.
You also describe how in 1985, there's a federal judge who determines that the aldermanic districts have been gerrymandered in a way that disenfranchised African-Americans, Latinos, and how that helped to change things around. And that points to also the degree to which Harold Washington had, you know, come to power, not just on the strength of African-Americans and a few white liberals, but through a rainbow coalition, and how that ends up playing a role in the dynamics of the 1987 mayoral election when he runs for a second term.
Right. That court decision was very important because it required, first of all, in 1986, it required special aldermanic elections to address that gerrymandering, and it required special elections in seven wards which were held. And as a result of those special elections, for the first time, The opponents of Harold Washington no longer had a working majority in the city council. 29-21, of course, had been the count previously, but after those 1986 special elections, it ended up with a 25-25 split. And because when there was a tie, the mayor cast the deciding vote, that for the first time then gave the Washington coalition control of the city council. And that was very important for, you know, for breaking through in some areas and getting some things done that, that couldn't be done previously, and also served as you say, a kind of harbinger of what his reelection would be like the following year, 1987, he came up for reelection.
As you describe, in some ways, the breakthrough, the deadlock, the change in the balance on the city council didn't help him in the sense that all of a sudden there were these raised expectations. And I thought the dynamic with the Latino population was especially interesting because of how Jane Byrne in particular targeted the Latino population in her bid to take the mayor's office back from Washington.
Right. After losing in 1983, Jane Byrne, I think, pretty much started campaigning for 1987 almost immediately. And one of the things that she did was to target the Latino population in Chicago as an area where she thought she could do very well. And so she began spending a lot of time in places like Little Village and Pilsen, the real Latino neighborhoods of Chicago, and going to festivals and making commercials in Spanish on television, this sort of thing, to endear herself with Latino voters. The Latino vote in 1983 had been an important part of the Washington Rainbow Coalition. And, you know, Jane Byrne thought she was going to do something about that. Ultimately, she didn't, of course. She did attempt to run again in 1987, but her campaign really didn't go anywhere. And Washington, again, in a bitter campaign, perhaps not quite as bad as the 1983 one, but another tough campaign in 1987, he was able to narrowly win re-election.
And in that re-election, you describe it, it's very curious how you have basically facing three other candidates, including Verdoliak, who doesn't run against Washington in the primaries, but, you know, adopts a third party label. So, and then you have another Democrat, Hines, running, and it just really gives a sense as to just the, you know, how dramatically the politics had shifted in Chicago by 1987, and yet Washington rises above that and succeeds in winning another term for himself.
Well, he did win another term for himself. And yet, I think somewhat sadly, after the election was over, he was in some ways quite bitter about it. He had just served 4 years in the mayor's office, thought that he had done some really good things despite staunch opposition, and really couldn't understand why he didn't win any more votes in 1987 than he did in 1983. And in fact, if you go back and look at the election numbers very carefully, there were fewer people who voted for Harold Washington in 1987 than did in 1983. And he was very bitter about that. He talked to folks off the record, behind the scenes, about how upset he was, how it appeared to him as though whites in Chicago were desperately seeking any alternatives they could so that they didn't have to vote for him. Yet, as you say, he was again able to cobble together enough of a coalition, African-Americans, Latinos, and white liberals to hang on to the office.
And he enters the second term, and there's a lot of opportunity ahead of him. You describe how he's focused on consolidating his base, on strengthening it. You talk about his agenda, and then it all comes to this very tragic end later in the year. What was his plan going forward? And then could you describe a bit what happened with his death?
Right. Well, after his election in April of 1987, he and his people got together very quickly and started to sketch out a large scale plan for the next 4 years. They talked about what they could do now, finally with a majority in the city council, how they could make infrastructure improvements and how they could bring more to the neighborhoods and so on and so forth. He really had a pretty lengthy agenda about what could be done. As I said, this was in April. And then in November, which is what, gosh, I should do my math, 6, 7 months later, he suddenly just died of a heart attack. And it was tragic in many ways. After such a difficult time for so long, he was finally in a position to do something. And almost immediately, he died very suddenly, and that was the end of it.
You describe how the nature, I mean, the suddenness of his death, it led to a lot of speculation among many of his supporters that he had been assassinated, and yet you describe it also as well the idea that the mayoralty did take a physical toll upon him in a lot of ways.
Yes, it did. I mean, there was a sense that he was a very hearty, a very vital man. There was really no indication that he was sick prior to his death. He just literally was sitting at his desk one day and in a meeting, and then just his head dropped over, hit the desk, and he was dead almost instantly from a massive heart attack. And so there was in the at the outset, a lot of questions about that, particularly in the African American community. People were skeptical in that racially charged environment. There were charges that there might have been some there might have been something going on behind the scenes. A lot of conspiracy theories that floated around and so on and so forth. But very quickly they did an autopsy, and the medical people said that he had died of a massive heart attack. Many of his arteries and valves around his heart were enlarged and blocked. He just wasn't in very good shape. Estimates are that he had gained in the 4 years he'd been in the mayor's office, he'd gained nearly 100 pounds from too much campaigning and not enough exercising. And so he really really was not, despite outward appearances, all that healthy.
What happened to the changes that he had implemented while he was mayor? What was what, you know, what elements of his legacy endured?
Well, that's an interesting question, and there are some scholars and some other folks who'd been around at that time who've debated that question. There are some scholars, for example, who argued that his mayoralty was a kind of one-off, that it was an aberration, that he managed to sort of break the political hold of the Democratic machine in Chicago as long as he was alive. But then pretty quickly after his death came Richard M. Daley, the son of Richard J. Daley, and that it was politics as usual fairly quickly afterwards. But on the other hand, there are people who say, well, Washington did make something of a difference. He showed Chicagoans and others what could be achieved. And most importantly, what if Harold had lived, they say? What if he had been able to implement many of the plans that he had drawn up, if he'd been around for another term or two terms, for example, look at what he might have achieved if he'd been able to re-energize the neighborhoods and if he'd been able to institute an element of openness and fairness, and Chicagoans became accustomed to that. That might have been a great change in the nature of Chicago politics and government.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, another historian, a friend of mine, Mark Rose, and I are working on a project that deals with deindustrialization and American cities. How have large American cities that were vitally important in the World War II effort in this country, the peak industrial cities in the 1940s and 1950s, how have they attempted to adjust to the many changes that have happened in recent years? And what we're doing is we're looking at five cities, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, and Philadelphia, and trying to determine what those cities have attempted to do and how successful they've been. Why has Chicago, for example, seemingly fared better than, well, Detroit, and so forth? So that's the current project.
Sounds like a fascinating project. Roger, thank you very much.
Well, we hope.
Roger, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks a lot.